This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. More than 1.6 million Floridians have already voted, either by mail or at early voting sites. Statewide races on the primary ballot include Governor, Attorney General, Agriculture Commissioner. County and city mayors are up for election, as are judges, school board members and congressional representatives. Issues like toxic algae, gun safety, healthcare and education funding have grabbed the headlines. But what's driving you to the ballot box, and which candidates have a platform to tackle the issues you think are important? Are you concerned about election security? What's the experience of voting like been for you? Join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can send us a tweet too. We're at WMFE Orlando. And with me in the studio, Republican political analyst Michelle Ertel. Michelle, welcome back to Intersection.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Democratic political analyst, former state representative Dick Batchelor. Dick, welcome back as well.
Good to be here.
You can join the conversation too. That number again, 1-866-338-5252. You want to hear what issues are important to you this election? Have you voted already? Are you leaving it till today? What's that experience of voting been like? You can also send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. In a moment, we're going to head to a polling station where 90.7's Emily Lang is standing by. But first, just a few thoughts on John McCain's passing. Michelle Ertel, what's his legacy and what do you think the GOP has lost with his passing?
We've lost something huge. We have lost a statesman, and that's very hard to find. In the Republican Party, we used to have a whole lot of statesmen, and with McCain's passing, it's a huge loss for us.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, there has been a lot said and written about his heroism as a prisoner of war, praised from both sides of the aisle. He's been seen as kind of like somebody who could put politics aside and maintain those personal friendships, even if people disagreed with him on his political issues. What does it mean for bipartisanship in Washington? And do you see somebody picking up that mantle?
Well, I think his voice is going to be really missed a great deal, because he tried to bring people somewhat, you know, to the middle on some of the issues. He was a maverick, very outspoken, of course. Of course, as a veteran, I admired him a great deal because I had not only served in Vietnam, but I went to Hanoi and visited the POW camp where he was, Hanoi Hilton. So I have a great admiration for his stature as a hero. Mm-hmm. He's really an American hero. But he will be missed, and you would hope others would pick up the mantle, like maybe Senator Lindsey Graham, his very best friend, and others. But we will see.
Well, let's move on. Let's talk about the primary election today. It's an important election. A lot of eyes across the nation on this election, of course. I want to go first to Emily Lang, 90.7's Emily Lang. She is standing by at the Jim Beach Recreation Center in Ocoee. Emily, what's it like there at the moment? How busy is it?
Hi, Matthew. So about 25 people have driven in the past hour. And mainly the people that I've talked to, they're focusing on issues surrounding voting itself. Mm-hmm. One woman was coming out of voting with her son in her arms, and she said she wished there was more education in schools and locally available about informing people on how important local elections are. Mm-hmm. She mentioned calling her mother and asking, how do you know who to vote for school board elections? And another man voting for the first time in Florida, he's from Maryland, said he didn't know half the people on the ballot. And he said he felt ashamed that he had to Google people while he was voting, and that in his home state, he felt like there was more accessible information about the broad range of different types of candidates.
Okay, so that's interesting. Any talk at all from the folks you spoke to about what sort of issues are important to them? We have heard a lot about things like the environment, school safety, gun safety, education funding, that sort of thing. What have you heard from folks so far, Emily, if at all?
One woman that I spoke to said she's really focusing on national topics of conversation. She's going into the polling booth thinking about not wanting to be censored online anymore, and she's really letting that drive her voting.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't want people to belittle her for her political beliefs, and that is driving how she's thinking going into the voting booth.
Sounds interesting. Well, thank you so much for that little update there, Emily. We'll check in with you later in the day as well. Emily Lang is out at the Jim Beach Recreation Center, a polling station in Ocoee. Emily, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Matt.
All right. Well, Dick Batchel, interesting comment from one of those voters there about not wanting to be shamed or attacked for a political belief. So we have heard a lot of rhetoric and vitriol in the last couple of years and even leading up to it as well. What are your thoughts there? Is that sort of a turnoff for people when they think about getting politically engaged?
I think so. To a lot of the social media where people tend to get most of their news now, can be very, very divisive. I mean, you can maybe go to the far right and far left and get what suits you best. But even things like Breitbart News are just so negative now in driving people, I think, their thought process on this. And they may or may not think they're being shut out of the process. But really, with social media, you really have an open invitation to express your opinion. So feel free to do so, of course.
Mm-hmm. I guess the kind of counterpoint to that, Michelle, is we are seeing an uptick in people either voting early, voting by mail. I mean, the numbers are higher than the 2014 primary. So what does that tell you about how politically engaged people are this year?
I think since 2020, people have been I'm sorry. Since 2016, people have been very, very engaged.
You're clairvoyant there.
whether they were pro-Trump or pro-Hillary, they have walked away from that with a lot of opinions and a lot of feelings. Some Democrats feel that that with Trump in the presidency, now is the time for them to take action. And Republicans who were pro-Trump are ready to dig in their heels and defend their spot in history.
Mm-hmm. And I guess folks kind of on the margins there, maybe Democrats see some opportunities to peel off some sort of middle-of-the-road Democrats in some races,
rather. And, you know, what's interesting with the political mails that I received from Republicans, these candidates couldn't be more anxious to tie themselves to Donald Trump. Just about everyone had a photo either with Donald Trump or that looked like they were with Donald Trump or I support Donald Trump. So that's huge, and we'll see how that plays out today.
And I think that the risk there is, you know, again, we talk about it all the time, the one thing Michelle and I agree on, Democrats run to the left to get the nomination in the primary, Republicans run to the right, you got to get back to the middle. But if DeSantis, who's been mostly closely tied, aligned with Trump, is the nominee, then how do you move back? You know, the Republicans supporting you in the primary very strong, but how do you appeal to the one-third NPAs and the Democrats, moderate Democrats? So watching these candidates in the general election with Trump might be watching somebody slow dance with a porcupine. Kind of want to be sort of close, but not too close.
I think the interesting thing, though, about DeSantis is you are seeing some kind of almost Democrat-leaning policy statements from him. If you hear him talking about the environment, like what's happening with the water quality in South Florida, some of the things that you are hearing from DeSantis, given that, of course, he is up against Adam Putnam in this primary, they do sound almost like platforms you might hear from a Democrat.
Well, I think what's driving that is his attack on Adam Putnam for taking money from U.S. Sugar, the Fonhoe brothers and others. So that he tied that to the environment as being sure advancing an anti-environment agenda. So I think it was more politically driven than it was philosophically driven.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
I want to just get a tweet in here from a listener. Rebecca writes, top voting issue for me is gun safety. Thankfully, many candidates who realize the seriousness of gun danger in Florida, and I guess especially, this is me interjecting here, especially with what happened over the weekend in Jacksonville, that tragedy there, it's kind of on people's minds. Back to this tweet from Rebecca. Voted early in Seminole County. Smooth, kind volunteers. I felt my vote was safe. So props to the Seminole County elections team there. Michelle, gun safety, though, clearly an issue that is driving voters this election season?
It is clearly an issue. Not so much for Republicans, because, of course, they are many of them have married up with the NRA. You know, I'm receiving, again, mailers that say lifelong member, pictures of them with guns in their hands. So it's more of an issue on the Democratic side. But Republicans have started on a national level to come out and say we need to start looking at mental health and some other things. But Republicans are never going to go for a gun ban.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, no one's advocated gun ban. There is also a lot of discussion on the Democratic side of the aisle about doing away with AR-15s semi-automatic weapons, things like that. That's probably the strongest position you've got. But I think it's an interesting issue, but I think it's interesting in the context of the Republican legislature and the Republican governor sign into law, you know, some gun safety regulations during the last session, and which were all opposed by the NRA. Mm-hmm. But NRA would step in. They spend a tremendous amount of money, not giving contributions, but in direct mail, which is certainly worth a tremendous amount of money.
You can call in 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can also send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Just back to the DeSantis-Putnam race, the governor's primary on the Republican side. Michelle Hurtel, how do you sort of read this at this point? It seems like it's fairly close polling-wise.
Well, you know, it depends on which poll you look at. You know, most of the polls do have DeSantis ahead, some with a bigger margin than others. But remember, in 2016, the polling, nobody expected it to turn out the way it did. If you have a landline, you're going to get those calls. But if all you have are a cell phone, you're not getting polled. So it's hard to say the accuracy of them. So, you know, I still say that this is going to be a referendum on Trump. If DeSantis wins with big numbers, Trump is still very, very popular.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this as a referendum on Trump, Dick Batchelor?
I do in the primary. Again, the numbers are very clear. 80% of the Republicans still support Trump, and they are if you look at the super voters, those people who vote in the primaries, those are hardcore and the more conservative Republicans. So I think DeSantis has it not only with the tweet endorsement, but also the president's now doing robocalls for him, reminding people that he is with Trump. Mm-hmm. So while he's putting about everything he has on Trump, but the momentum might be with him, even though the polls show it close. What's going to be interesting after the campaign at the primary is look at the polls, because some of them are so far apart, they can't all be right.
No, they're not. They're not.
I'm going to go to the phones now. I've got a caller now, I believe, who has an issue at polls. Go ahead. You're on the air. Are you there? We seem to have lost that call, unfortunately. But if you do have any issues at the polls, or if you want to talk about your voting experience, give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. I want to hear about the issues that are motivating you this morning as well. Frank the Gardener writes, "Good morning, first primary in which my family and I voted early. We received so many ads that we could not discern how reliable the description of the candidates were. We went on the very little personal info we knew. Very subjective." Interesting point there, Michelle. You were talking about the kind of campaign literature that people get bombarded with. How useful is some of that stuff?
You know, people who are educated on the candidates, people like Dick and I who actually know the bottom line, we look at most half of them and say, oh, this is a load of malarkey. Am I right?
Politely, yes.
But I do think some people believe it. You know, I think it just – look, the onus is on people need to do their research. Mm-hmm. People need to do the research because much of what they hear or hear on TV ads and read in these mailers is what the candidate wants you to think.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so amorphous, too. It's like I'm going to stimulate the economy. Well, you don't know. You know, you're running for a local office. You're not going to do anything that stimulate the economy. Or I'm for – better schools, okay. I'm for a protective environment, okay. But maybe in the general election, they will come out with very specific platforms. I think part of it's really the burden falls on the voter. Demand answers, not just pablum, but demand very specific answers. What were you going to do about education? Are you going to vote for more funding? Where is it coming from, very specifically? Mm-hmm. Or whether it's guns or whatever. The one thing I want to point out is I think, and to give shout out to Senator Bob Graham and also former Congressman Lou Fry, keep in mind, they got together and lobbied the legislature to require civics to be taught in the schools again. It's not well funded yet, but at least there's an effort to teach. And I think at the college level, there's going to be a requirement for civics. So that will help people begin to understand why they're getting their education, the importance of government and how you can influence government. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that will encourage a lot more young people to be involved.
I want to just dive into some of the other races aside from the gubernatorial election. Well, actually, before we do that, let's just jump into the Democratic primary for a moment. Dick Batchelor, it's such a crowded field, right? You've got five candidates there. I read last night that one of those candidates has actually cancelled his election night party.
Yes.
Interesting move there. What do you read into that?
Well, Jeff Green, not only he poured out his advertising, he spent about $29 million of his own money. He's a billionaire, multi-billionaire. Mm-hmm. And then he said, I'm pulling out the ads. But he goes, well, no, really, I'm going to go back on, but then I'm not going to have a victory party. I'm going to watch it at home. So, I mean, you're out. I mean, you when you got out, you actually got out of the race. So this race is going to be close. To what's fascinating to watch is Andrew Gillum, mm-hmm. the mayor of Tallahassee, African-American, who got endorsed by Bernie Sanders. He came to the state. George Soros and Thomas Steyer put in about $1.3 million over the last weekend. And he's moving up in the polls, which is fascinating. And he's, according to one poll, and who knows if they're accurate, he's almost like in tie in second place with Levine.
Hmm.
So it's a very fascinating poll. But again, but that's a poll. It's late money. But he's really moved up a lot. And he could probably, depending on who the nominee is, be in a consideration for maybe a running mate.
That's interesting. Real quick, the Agriculture Commission, Michelle Urtel, who's your pick in the Republican primary there?
My preference, or who do I think is going to win?
Who looks likely to you?
I think that it's what I'm seeing is Matt Caldwell. He has been everywhere. He has put over 80,000 miles on his car. His hashtag is two-lane travel. He's taken back roads and has just been out meeting people. And I'm a big believer that knocking on doors and meeting people is what will win an election. And he's certainly done the work.
Mm-hmm. If you talk about the we're talking about the Democratic primary, Dick Batchelor, Agriculture Commission. I mean, there are so many issues you could think about there. There's obviously the algae sort of being a top of mind issue there.
Right.
Is that something that is making people pay more attention to this race this time around?
Not a great deal, I don't think, except Adam Putnam holds that position now, and he's been very vocal on some of the environmental issues. But Nikki Fried, the Democrat, is going to win that one. But really what begs the question of, really, why do you want to be agriculture commissioner, really?
Mm-hmm.
And look at Nikki Fried, and you go like, you're not a farmer. I mean, what do you want to be an agriculture commissioner? Same reason that Adam Putnam did, because he wants to run for governor. Nikki Fried's 40 years old. She could spend a couple of terms there and then move along. But, I mean, so it really begs the question of, why do you want to be agriculture commissioner? Is it a stepping stone to the governor's chair, or do you really do want to tend to the environmental interests of the state?
Mm-hmm. Well, and she's also been a marijuana lobbyist. So, you know, that is something that I'm sure will be put to good use as ag commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
She's got a lot of knowledge in that.
And then if you look at the attorney general's race, Dick Batchelor, the Democrats have a candidate who got dumped off the ballot and then went back on. What's going on here, Ryan Torrance?
Well, he's gone. I mean, I think Shaw's going to win that one hands down. And so the guy, whether or not he's off or back on, he doesn't have a campaign going into this. So I think we'll have a strong Democratic nominee in that one.
Mm-hmm. We're at WMFU Orlando. If you want to reach out with your comments and questions on Twitter, I'd love to get your comments there. Michelle Urtel, the Republicans running for Attorney General. I mean, they're looking to replace Pam Bondi, who's been there for a few years now. Has she kind of set the stage for what to expect from a Republican in that seat?
Well, she's done a really good job. Republicans like her. She's been moonlighting on Fox News.
Yeah,
I saw that.
Auditioning, maybe.
Maybe on the five. Ashley Moody has been endorsed by Pam Bondi. She has been endorsed by law enforcement. She has got prosecutorial experience. I'm going to go with Ashley Moody on this.
And I think Frank White, the other Republican in that race, really kind of stepped on it. Actually, the interview with Greg Fox on Channel 2 here basically took the interview, splashed the interview, and made it look like as if he was endorsed by, I think it was one of the sheriffs anyway. But anyway, it came out that they actually splashed the interview to make it look like an endorsement, which it wasn't. So he's a blowback we've got. And then, of course, running the campaign.
I was wondering about that because I saw those two ads running side by side during Jeopardy or something the other night. And it looked like you basically had sort of warring sheriff's endorsements, which is kind of unusual. Usually sheriffs will line up behind one candidate.
Yeah. You do. And also, I think the Frank White, what he's done too, is, I mean, try to paint Moody as a liberal, radical liberal,
and she's not.
So I think he put like $2 million on money in the race. He might have been well spent elsewhere.
Not a great investment.
Don't think so.
A tweet here from Brandon. He writes, did early voting on Sunday, Orange City, in and out in 5 minutes. I did my research prior. Shout out to the Orlando Sentinel's coverage, though it would be nice if you didn't count the number of free web page views for voting coverage. Educate the electorate. So education and people wanting some little more information on research ahead of time is kind of a key issue there. There are so many races. There are not only obviously these big statewide races, but we've got local mayoral elections. Quickly, Dick Batchelor, the Orange County mayoral election. There's a little bit of fire and fury in there, yeah. But where do you see that going?
I think Jerry wins it tonight without a runoff. Rob Pinapinto's raised a lot of money, about $750,000. It came on with a surge. And I think Teresa Jacobs going after Jerry about the deputies in the schools, not having enough of them, really benefited her campaign for chairmanship of the school board, and I think it also benefited Rob Pinapinto to tap down Jerry a little bit. But I think with Jerry's name recognition, sheriff 10 years, and $1.3 million that he had to spend, I think I don't think he's going to have a problem.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Ertel, let me just ask you real quick about the mayor of Sanford. He's running again for re-election. I mean, he's spoken on numerous occasions in the past about this is going to be his last term. He seems to enjoy that role, though.
He loves this role. He's out there this morning. I saw on Facebook campaigning. He has good spirits, and he's done a very good job. The city of Sanford had some very dark days, and
Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, and Jeff Triplett led them through it. Other cities had riots and violence and terrible things happen. Sanford came out of it ahead, and a lot of that can be credited to Jeff Triplett. I think he wins, and I think he takes it away tonight.
I wanted to talk real briefly, too, about some of the congressional races. There are some interesting primaries there. One of them is District 7. You've got a GOP primary, folks lining up against Stephanie Murphy. That's her district there. What are you hearing, Michelle Ertel, about Mike Miller and his race against Scott Sturgill?
Well, that is probably one of the ugliest races I have ever seen. They are two guys. I know both of them. And they're both really nice guys. Yeah. And this has taken a turn.
In real life.
This has taken, politics makes people who they aren't. And this is a perfect example of that. My guess is whoever was less ugly wins this race. That's all I can say. I don't know what the polling says. I don't buy polls for the most part. But man, I've never seen anything like it.
You know, it's going to be conservative competing who's the most Trump, pro-Trump on this. And I think we discussed before, you've got one of them attacking somebody for being in favor of the Affordable Care Act, and the other commercial is against the same guy for doing the same thing. And then, of course, one is proud to say he's endorsed by Roger Stone. So, I mean, you really are seeking votes if you're publicizing an endorsement for Roger Stone, who may or may not be able to vote next year.
On the other side of the aisle, DeSoto versus Grayson, Dick Batchelor in that district there. Is DeSoto vulnerable here, do you think?
I don't think so. I think Darren Soto is fine because he's the incumbent. He's had the money. Congressman John Lewis endorsed him, now endorsed him. He's raised to be able to raise the money. And I think Grayson just probably – he really was trying to get that vote from MoveOn.org to the left, and that's a sliver. And to keep in mind, this district goes over to Polk County, and Bartow ain't the Bronx.
I guess the demographics, though, are changing a little bit in Polk County.
They're changing a little bit, but, we're basically trying to say Grayson can run far to the left and win in Polk County. There might be some Democrats in Bartow, but there ain't no socialists in Bartow.
Where do you see Grayson hitting next, then, if this is not a success for him?
Well, he's a wealthy man, so I don't know what he'll do next. You lost a U.S. Senate race. If he loses this race again, I don't see much of a political future unless he's going to be on MSNBC.
I don't know. Are you of the school that believes, you lose twice, you're done?
I think so. Yeah. I think once you lose twice, it's over.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see. Well, we'll have more election coverage tonight. You can tune in for newscasts from 7, 8 and 9. This evening we'll have our reporters out in the field with the DeSantis and the Gwen Graham election night parties here in the Orlando area. You're listening to Intersection, and we've been speaking to Democratic political analyst, former State Representative Dick Batchel. Thanks for being here.
Go out and vote.
And Republican political analyst Michelle Urtel. I know she voted already. She's wearing the sticker. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, what is sustainability and how are students in Rollins pursuing their goals in sustainability? Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. From the Education Desk this week, a conversation about sustainability and what that means for college students. 15 students from Rollins College have been picked for the Millennium Fellowship. It's a leadership program that aims to let students advance United Nations sustainability goals on campus and in the wider community. Joining me to talk more about the fellowship is Rollins College Provost, Dr. Susan Singer. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And we're also joined by one of the fellowship students, Christina Fullahan. She's a biochemistry and philosophy double major. Christina, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Susan, I want to start with you. What does this mean for the college?
Well, this opportunity is so in sync with the work we're already doing at Rollins. We have a long history of doing work that has strong social impact, working on major goals through our social innovation and entrepreneurship hub. We're one of a very small number of colleges and universities in this country that are both Ashoka Changemaker campuses, and there's a Carnegie classification for community engagement. Mm-hmm. So it's right in line with our key emphasis.
All right. So, Christina, let me bring you into this conversation. These are some pretty lofty goals, right? The UN Sustainable Development Goals, they're very broad. Zero hunger, clean water, gender equality. How do you take a goal like that and narrow it down so you've got a project that you can actually get done?
Well, the goal of the program, Millennium Fellowship, is supposed to coincide with students' passion projects. So we have on campus, students interested in environmental sustainability, students interested in immigration enforcement in the United States and the effects of new ICE laws. Mm-hmm. We have students interested in education and medicine, and we are empowered by a network of fellow students from all across 57 different countries to continue those goals. We collaborate with other students on innovating new ideas and expanding our personal projects. So It really is providing a network.
Talking about passion projects then, what is your passion project?
I have several different projects that I've been working on since I was freshman year that range from medical mission trips to education efforts. The key project that I am hoping to accomplish through my work with the Millennium Fellowship revolves around an organization I joined freshman year of college. It's a national student-led organization called Paper Airplanes that has students from all over the world tutoring Syrian refugees that had their education disrupted. And our goal is to educate them in English and attain a sufficient level of fluency for them to be able to pass the TOEFL and pursue education efforts abroad.
Why were you drawn to this project? What makes it special to you?
Because I was really fortunate through Rollins. I received an Alphonse scholarship. It's a merit-based scholarship that really allows you to challenge yourself and encourages you. It's a full scholarship to find different outlets through Rollins to help you grow as an individual and become your best. And so because I was gifted an opportunity to grow myself and continue my education, I want other people to have that opportunity as well, who were not as fortunate as I am.
Mm-hmm. And I guess Syrian refugees, I mean, they've gone through some of the worst times any human can experience, right?
Of course. And the sad thing is that we forget. People are so focused on their own issues that every time there's a new news cycle, there's another story that takes the headlines. And people forget that these people are suffering every single day. Their story doesn't stop.
Mm-hmm. I read, too, that as part of the project, students are going to figure out whether they'll work on their own or as part of a group. So how's it going to work for the Rollins students who are part of this fellowship?
So what's nice about the MCN program is that they're allowing us some flexibility. The curriculum is very structured, but I'm going to be working with our team at Rollins through the Social Innovation Hub, as well as through different faculty members on campus, such as Dr. J and, of course, Dean Singer, that are going to provide the students the support needed to be able to come together as a team and not only work on their own projects, but potentially come together as a group and focus on other projects as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that flexibility that the program offers you really is the key aspect of the program, I believe, because it's empowering us to do more. There's no limit on what we can do as a university partnering with the Millennium Fellowships.
Mm-hmm. Susan Singer, it sounds like in some ways what comes out of this is kind of unwritten, right? I mean, you're not entirely sure what could come out of this project.
So that's the beauty of the adventure. Actually, that's the beauty of the Rollins career. We have our students start from the very first day engaged in community service, actually even before they set foot in the classroom. We have a curriculum that everyone takes that it prepares them to work in this really integrated space, because no one discipline has the ability to solve these really, really complex problems. So students learn to work across disciplines. They learn to work towards solving important real-world problems that make their hearts sing. And so they're ready to go. And every student that graduates from Rollins has a different story to tell about how their general education, their major, and all of their other experiences, whether they're global, their community engagement, their participation in the Millennium Fellowships program, all come together to empower them to work on teams to contribute to solutions to the most pressing problems we face as a world.
What is the Social Innovation Hub?
So the Social Innovation Hub is a result of our work as an Ashoka Changemaker University. It is supported by a faculty director and a full-time staff director. It's a physical space where students come and do design thinking and work on problems. But much more importantly, it's a programmatic space where we have the resources, the talent available to support the students in achieving their goals, their dreams. So we give them the tools, we open the doors for them, but they build what is important.
Mm-hmm. What about the network of other universities that, you know, Christina was talking about? There are other campuses across the globe that are part of this fellowship, right? I mean, does Rollins already have some partnerships with universities elsewhere or campuses offsite?
Yeah, so we have a whole new network now, and Christina is going to be coordinating with these 30 campuses. There's some intersections, of course, with our, say, the Ashoka Changemakers Network, which is a network, again, an international network of colleges and universities. And yes, there's folks from New Zealand and Australia in there. And we come together with them annually, but we communicate throughout the year where our work intersects and we share resources, insights, experiences, and, you know, we're all collectively better together.
Do you think universities are becoming more places where there isn't necessarily, you know, the kind of physical campus or the location isn't necessarily so important? Obviously, there's kind of online courses you can take and things like that. But just even this project here, which links together all these different campuses, is that sort of the future for universities?
So I think it's actually a both and. We want our students out in the world. We celebrate the location of Rollins, which is unusual for a liberal arts college. Many are in remote rural places. We're right in the middle of a dynamic global city where our students have the opportunity to engage. The both part in terms of the physical space. We're actually in the midst of a major project in the center of campus to renovate and add on to our iconic building in the center of campus to create a space where we have an even more effective hub. We bring together our Center for Global Initiatives, our Center for Leadership and Community Engagement, our Career and Life Planning, and many other supports where we, in a physical space, have the interactions between folks on a daily basis to support and create new visions to engage our students. But our goal is to get them out in the world. So it's definitely a both and.
When you say dynamic global city, are you talking about Winter Park or are you talking about Orlando?
I'm talking about Orlando and Central Florida. We have students that are doing phenomenal work up in Apopka with migrant farm workers, and they're always partnerships. So in partnership, our students live with migrant families for a short amount of time. That supports the migrant families. They learn about the work. They learn about farming. We have over 200 true partnerships in an education, in health and environment with the Central Florida community. So we're contributing, our students are learning, and the academic and the co-curricular broader experiential learning all come together in ways that we feel we're a valuable member of the community and really add value to the learning experience of all our students.
Christina Fullerton, how will you know if this project has been a success? Like, is there going to be a certain point where you're like, yep, we've nailed it? Or is it just sort of an evolving process as far as you're concerned?
I think that it's really the students' input that's going to matter in this. What we want is to encourage our students, our Millennium Fellows, the 15 chosen by the United Nations program, that if they can come at the end of the day and say, we were able to meet our goal, or even if they weren't able to meet their goal, I mean, each project is likely to have meet successes and failures. That's normal everyday life. If they can come and say, we learned from this, we now have a community, we now have a network, we now know what our next steps are, and we feel like we've grown as leaders and as change makers and as global citizens from this project, then I'm going to label it a success. Mm-hmm. And Rollins has a lot of experience. I mean, global citizenship and responsible leadership really is at the essence of everything Rollins preaches on campus and off campus. So I have no doubt that hopefully with the leadership of the great faculty and mentors at Rollins, this is going to be a success, even though I don't want to jinx it, but knock on wood.
Right. In some ways, it sounds like you might have to wait a little bit sort of after you've graduated, kind of check back in and see what people are doing. Is that something you want to do as well? Kind of keep tabs on how people are evolving after they graduate?
Of course. I mean, there's a lot of alumni outreach programs at Rollins. We have alumni achievement awards. So, and a lot of the alumni that come back on campus have done entrepreneurship, have succeeded in these disciplines outside of what they were able to accomplish in college.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this fellowship, does it sort of change your idea about what sustainability means?
Yes, it's the UN defines it in a much, as you mentioned earlier, in a much more broad way than I had previously heard the word used before. And I think that it's for the better. It's very important that people feel like their own interests, their own goals fit into the overall ideology that we're trying to promote through the Millennium Fellowship and through our affiliation with the United Nations. So the sustainability has broad reaches in many, many different disciplines. And I think it's important for us to realize that it doesn't only relate to the environment or to climate change, where the word is most commonly used.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with her. Our general education curriculum is built around themes that are truly global challenges, but achieving a just and equitable world is every bit as important as having clean water, making sure there's sufficient food and energy for everyone. It's a whole system.
Mm-hmm. Christina Fullerton, have you guys kind of met together and sort of discussed what the plan is?
So the first meeting is going to be on this Wednesday. I've been in communication with the other fellows, and they're all very, very excited. And to be honest, their list of accomplishments is really, really inspiring, and I'm excited and honored to work with all of them on their goals. We have people who already have made headway into their projects. We have people who have been working with the Democracy Project on campus for years and are hoping to give us a 40% voter turnout at Rollins for the midterm election when other colleges only have 20%. And they've already made headway onto that and on that call. We have other students working to raise money to build a water tank that funds a community garden in Rwanda that helps feed impoverished community there, and that's also a Rollins program that has been in place for several years now. And so some people's projects might be still in the earlier phases, but everyone has a plan, and I am going to be meeting one-on-one with them outside of that meeting on Wednesday to ensure that they get all the support that I'm able to provide and that Rollins is able to provide.
Well, Christina Fullerton is one of the fellowship students, part of the United Nations Millennium Fellowship. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Dr. Susan Singer. She is the provost at Rollins College. Dr. Singer, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, with the events of last Sunday, Jacksonville joined a grim list of Florida cities where a mass shooting has taken place. As more and more newsrooms across the United States are confronted with the trauma of mass shootings, journalists are reaching out to their peers for guidance and support. A conversation about covering trauma when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando, Las Vegas, Sutherland Springs, Parkland, and now Jacksonville. These are just some of the cities across the United States confronted with mass shootings and their aftermath. Covering these traumatic events presents a practical and psychological challenge that can stretch the resources of a newsroom and its reporters. So, after connecting on Facebook last November, the Orlando Sentinel's senior health reporter, Nassim Miller, and the San Antonio Express News immigration reporter, Sylvia Foster Frau, decided to form a support network. The private Facebook group, Journalists Covering Trauma, now has hundreds of members. I caught up with Miller and Foster Frau at the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference in Orlando back in June. Miller began by talking about the practical support that newsrooms receive.
Some of the newspapers in Florida and elsewhere, they started sending us care packages, which had, you know, small bits of food, snacks, little silly toys. They sent us pizza. They catered food for us. And that makes such a huge difference because you're working around the clock. People are sleeping in the newsroom. And the emotional side of it is, you know, somebody's thinking about you, because it's very difficult covering your community that's going through such trauma, because it is your community at the same time. You're not reporting on some abstract news. You're living here, where as a, you know, resident, you're affected, and at the same time you have to report on it. So just those little tokens made such a big difference for us. So shortly after Pulse, there was the shooting in Dallas. So of course, what we did was send them a care package. So it became sort of a tradition. And of course, when the Sutherland shooting happened, it was only natural to, hey, everybody, we need to put a care package. And people are more than happy to bring in little snacks, Play-Doh, magazines to, you know, send over to help other reporters just a little bit.
And I know in the Sentinel's case, there were some former or some retired Sentinel staffers who came back. Like, I think Mike Lafferty showed up and helped you guys out too, didn't he?
Yeah, it's unfortunately, when these tragedies happen, it's all hands on deck. And you can't have enough reporters because there's so much happening. It's like your unfortunate day-to-day shooting multiplied by many.
What's your sense, Sylvia, of, you know, what sort of things people are looking for when they join the Facebook group? Like, what were you looking for when you started it? What did you think? Oh, we need this. There's something missing here. We can provide this with a support network of fellow journalists.
Yeah, so I think the idea was for it to be both personal and emotional support and also professional support. with the kind of dwindling resources in newsrooms as we kind of try to figure out this new digital era, there aren't a lot of supports in place that maybe used to be there and that we might need. So we have like a tip and resource sheet on the page that just has practical tips for how to cover a mass shooting, apps you can download, things that you should take with you, those kinds of just like on the ground practical things. Also, it's a place of discussion, so you can have, you know, Nassim will post something about whether or not to use the gunman's name in news reporting. That's been a subject of debate. Or when do you decide to report on a conspiracy theorist? You know, when does it reach the point when their names should be mentioned in the news? So we also like to bring up kind of those ethical questions. And then it is also just a place where you can hopefully find emotional and mental support, because covering those shootings takes a toll on you. You're doing a job, but it also, I mean, I'll just speak for myself, it like really changed me as a person. I'd never been surrounded by so much grief before and had to look people in the eyes and they talked about like the worst thing that's ever happened to them and just like absorb that. And then in some cases, you know, try to write about it. It's a life-changing experience. And so to have a network of people who have also gone through that similar experience, I think there's some comfort in that.
Did it make you question at any stage, like, why am I doing this job?
You know, it never did make me question that. If anything, it just made me more committed to what I do. I remember, like, I started reading other stories of that people had done in past mass shootings, and the ones that I really liked, I was like, I want to do it like this. I want to make it this good, like, and like really feeling like, how can I do these people justice? And I actually had like a lot of like anxiety, and like I felt a lot of pressure over like words just never seemed good enough for what they were going through, you know? So like trying to grapple with that was a struggle, but it was also coming from a place of like, I felt like my job was really important.
What about yourself, Nassim? I mean, talking about that idea of an event as big and traumatic as Pulse, for example, how do you feel that changed you?
Well, I grew up in a war when I was a child, and I do remember having to go to the basement and the next day going, figuring out where the bomb fell, hearing about fatalities all the time from the war. So having this happen here in Orlando, where I've lived for more than two decades, it opened a lot of wounds again, and I couldn't believe it's happening again. And hearing similar stories, but in a civilian world, it's difficult. I cover healthcare, so talking to surgeons, trauma surgeons, and hearing that for some of them who had been in the military, that some of these wounds were kind of like what they had seen in the military, it just did not make sense to me. And that's part of the reason, as we were talking, we thought creating this group is important, because I think the emotional and mental health of journalists for a long time traditionally is not part of the job. Like, nobody talks about it. And in our exchange, I was telling her, you know, on the day that Pulse happened, I had a Gatorade in my car and it sort of fell from my hand and it spilled on the car mat. And I didn't wash that until recently. I don't know why. And we just thought there is a need for us to have support group, to at least be in a group to know that we all know what everybody else goes through. But I really think newsrooms need to address this more. As Sylvia was mentioning, this is secondhand trauma in a way. You're hearing these stories, you know, similar to how ICU nurses hear the survivor stories, or trauma surgeons and ER physicians hear traumatic stories. We feel guilty about feeling traumatized because we weren't there. We weren't in the crowd. We weren't shot. But at the same time, you are hearing the stories. And I think it's somehow newsrooms have to have debriefings, mental health care, and put more emphasis on it for reporters.
And that was Nassim Miller and Sylvia Foster-Frau talking about the Facebook group Journalists Covering Trauma. That conversation was recorded and first aired last June. You can find a longer version on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Danielle Pryor answered the phones. Our intern is Shania Richberg. Find us on the NPR One app, download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.